And welcome once again, folks, to All Things Trek here on TrekRio.net. I'm Bob.
And I'm Oren.
And I'm Grace.
Oh, good. You did that without prompting. I was expecting to have to, like, you know, like, give you a little treat as the new co-host and be like, no, now's when you say your name.
Oren, you're close enough that I can elbow you in the face.
Uh-oh.
This is the problem.
You know, it's not good to threaten your employer. That's not a good practice.
I'm not sure I count as an employer.
I'm not getting paid for this. I'm getting paid in chicken noodle soup.
No, you're getting paid in quality.
You're getting paid in internet fame. You're getting paid in being internet celebrity status.
Such as it is.
5,000 quatloos. All right, everyone. So first of all, today is our 80th episode, which I'm pretty stoked about. Not so stoked that I did anything special, but still pretty stoked.
We're octogenarian.
We are. And really, I mean, I'm just waiting because when Podcast UGC finally like self-destructs in a terrible ball of fire, we will be the oldest Star Trek podcast that I know about.
Oh, yeah.
Because, unfortunately, Podcast UGC is, like, almost, I think, 4 months older than us. So, Bob, I need you to get on that.
We just need to go out there and get, like, the blue turtle shell of podcasting.
It's true. We have a man on the inside, don't we? And that's me.
just wait, Bob. It'll be really... We will taste the sweet fruits of victory.
Yes, it's all a plan that I've been hatching over the course of the past 7 months. Of course, you're on to me now.
And then, you know, and then once that's done, we can go take out the Lou Trek Show, which is the other super old Star Trek podcast that I know of. But I haven't listened to them yet, so they don't really count. Okay, guys. So Grace is back this week, which is really cool.
Hey.
And I have, as I sometimes do, I'm going to put to us the latest StarTrek.com poll, because I find those to be amusing. So the current poll is, which piece of Trek tech would you want the most? And the options are holodeck, phaser, communicators, tricorders, Geordi's visor, or the replicator. And chat room, please go ahead and throw out your own answers to this. I'd like to hear what you have to say.
But Bob is even a discussion about what we would want.
Yeah.
The replicator.
Replicator? Is that your pick?
If the replicator doesn't win, my faith in humanity will be lost.
I don't know. I think I'm going to
think about it. If I have the replicator, I can just replicate all the other things. It's like being able to go to the genie and saying, yeah, I wish for more wishes. You know?
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, this is
you replicate a phaser or a tricorder?
Sometimes.
I don't see why you couldn't replicate the parts. You know, just put it together. You know,
have to replicate an instruction manual too.
Does the replicator?
This is all taken care of. Got this.
Does it have the schematics to do all those things? I mean, I don't know. I might go with a holodeck.
Well, if we're going with the caveat that the replicator needs to be programmed by you, then I'd probably instead go with, you know, probably the phaser.
A phaser, really?
Yes.
Why don't you just go for like a laser pointer or something while you're at it?
I think
instead
I would probably
have a phaser.
I think I would probably go for a holodeck, to be honest. I mean, I guess I would go for a replicator if this was real, because replicators could, like, solve a lot of our problems.
Yeah.
But the holodeck would, I think, probably be the most fun.
Pretty much. I mean, with the replicator, I'd never have to cook again, but with the holodeck, I'd never have to leave the house again.
Yeah, that would be pretty nice.
But you have to program the replicator, and you have to program the holodeck.
I think I could figure out the holodeck. I'm pretty sure I could program that.
You think you could figure out the holodeck? Yeah, then you can figure out the replicator. I mean...
Well, I mean, I could figure out the replicator, but I don't think I could tell the replicator how to make a phaser, because I don't know how a phaser works. I could be like, I want you to make something that, you know, shoots a charged energy beam, and it would be like, what does that mean? Explain yourself. Whereas I imagine programming the holodeck would be kind of like, you know, would be kind of like using WordPress. A lot of drag and drops.
I don't know, I like the idea with the replicator of bringing fine dining right into your home.
Yeah,
you
I mean,
can eat anything.
I'm sure with the replicator, cheap. I could program it to make food, which would probably be, you know, I'd probably just fly over to various, you know, neighborhoods and countries that are having like hunger problems and be like, replicator, make bread. You know,
these starving children need filet mignon, chop chop.
So you know, things like or you know,
and pre-chew it for them.
Be like, replicator, I'm a little bit short on gold. I would like some of that, please. And, you know, I feed some rocks into it, now comes some gold. I'd be pretty happy with it.
Replicator, I need the newest Sims expansion pack. Sharpish.
Yeah, Data Logan's got my back. He's telling us that we need plans to replicate anything with the replicator.
A self-replicating replicator?
No, they did that in Deep Space Nine, but it was still stupid. But in any case, so is anything else going on interesting with you guys before we head into the emails? Because we got a lot.
I work hard. I work very hard now.
Are you the supervisor?
Well, I think I mentioned that last week because I got promoted. Did I mention that last week?
I mentioned last week that you were going to be promoted. Maybe I'm wrong.
Okay, well, that actually happened now, and I am now making more money, and I have more responsibilities, but man, is it sucking up my free time. Holy crap.
Is it, you just work more hours, or do you have, like, on-site things that you need to be doing while you're off work?
Both. I do have to do both. There's just an expectation of more. That's all it is. That's what comes with promotion, man, is that, you have to do more things. And there's more meta levels now associated with, like, what I do in regards to work, you know? It's not just me being at the site taking care of those responsibilities, but I have to go beyond those responsibilities, and not just that, also create work for myself, you know? So, And I have an unfortunate habit of doing that very prolifically. So, here we are.
Well, at least it's a move up, even if it is a move up into more work. And you have more to look forward to than Quatloos.
I do have more to look forward to than Quatloos. It's true.
Something else that I thought
is
was kind
of... Is Quatloos like the word of the day for you or something?
Quatloos is my imaginary currency. What do you want from me? speaking of things that are imaginary, I noticed that Star Trek Online is like boasting about how you can watch Enterprise on there now. And this struck me as being really funny for some reason because I have Netflix and I've been...
Wait, did you say Star Trek Online?
Sorry, Star Trek.
StarTrek.com. There you go.
I said what I meant.
And you meant what you said?
Yes. So anyway, StarTrek.com... is boasting that you can watch Enterprise online through it. And it's kind of funny to me because it's like, well, or you could have Netflix. I mean, Netflix is cheaper than cable, so it's probably just the better option. And you can watch all the Star Treks through Netflix. But other than that, I think unless you guys have more random things to say, move into the emails.
Oh, did you want to go talk about our impending tech solutions?
Actually, I think I'll wait on that because some of it's still up in the air. So I want to make sure I actually know what's happening before I say anything about it. Because otherwise, I might look
silly. Okay, that's fair.
And heaven knows I have never looked silly on this podcast before.
Oh, God forbid.
All right.
This is a very serious podcast, in case you're just tuning in.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We are super serious.
Serious as a brain tumor.
Now I'm sad, Grace.
You guys say it like that. You're trying to make people think it's a joke, but the delivery makes me think that you're actually being serious and that it is serious. It's very droll, so.
I have one more thing that's kind of Star Trek related. So my friend of mine was looking to get me a copy of, a Stitch in Time, which is the book by Robert, I can never remember the name of Garrick's actor. Andrew J. Robinson. He wrote a book called Stitch in Time, which is about Garrick.
Oh, and it's also a tailoring reference because they're stitching.
Yes.
See what they did.
And I really want to read it. And my friend was trying to buy it for me, and the ebook version is $8, and like the print book version is something like $40 or $50 because it's out of print and it's really rare. But I don't have an e-reader. So instead of getting me the book, he just got me a Kindle.
Oh my gosh.
I can go buy a Stitch in Time. Because the Kindle was only like a few dollars more than the actual book would have been, which I thought was funny. And I haven't gotten it yet, but I'm gonna. It's gonna be the first like Star Trek novel I've read in a long time. I mean, I read The Needs of the Many, but that was more of a here's what's going on in Star Trek Online than a novel.
But because you got the Kindle for Star Trek related reasons, you're gonna refer to it as your data pad, right?
Probably.
Awesome.
I'm gonna see if I can set it up with the L cars.
So I wonder if you could all, like, jimmy that through, like, being, like, a tax deduction at all, because this is a thing that you work at.
Maybe.
And you spend money on it, so I'm just saying,
I do. Although I think I might be hard-pressed to, put this down as a charitable expense. but we had
Sweet, sweet charity.
We had an email from a fellow who goes by Tapos, who I'm actually not going to read this week because it suggested a really cool topic that we are going to use as our topic of discussion next week. So from there, I will go into the art. We have 5 more emails after that. All right, come on. We're going to do this.
Woohoo!
All right. Fellow who I will identify as Roger, since I do not know what he likes to be called, he sent us an email saying, I have recently started downloading and listening to your show, at least as much as the server will let me. And then he has this little angry emoticon-looking thing.
Frowny face.
That's not a frowny face. That guy's clearly just mad. Look at that. He's got his eyes are all narrow.
Tetris rage.
Tetris rage? Is that what that is?
It
reminds me of like a little Tetris block is what it is. Like Tetris rage.
At us.
Yes. I've also started watching the reviews over on SF Debris, starting with Threshold, and it was the first time I enjoyed it. Granted, it was the second time I'd ever seen this episode. The reasons for this email is that I had a topic of discussion for y'all. Mm. And yes, I'm really, I think that if you listen to our show, you pretty much have to go watch SF Debris. So if for no other reason than because you will know what I'm talking about, finally.
It's like a secret decoder ring for Oren's references.
Yes. I have listened to the episode where y'all discussed your opinions for the 2009 movie, and while I could state my own opinion of the movie, it is easier to simply point you to the SF Debris review. Which I will admit, the SF Debris review I thought was one of his not great reviews. I thought he could have said more, but moving on. So the question is, what would Star Trek Into Darkness have to do to be considered by you to be a successful Star Trek movie? And just for the fun of it, what would it have to do to be considered a truly terrible Star Trek movie? I look forward to hearing the response and the rage. All right, well, I'll let someone else go first, because I've got some things to say.
Bob, why don't you start us off?
To be considered a successful Star Trek movie, if we're already going with the premise that the first Star Trek movie, the 2009 one anyway, was, could be considered a full-fledged Star Trek movie in its own right, just be better and expand upon the material that's there. That's probably the one thing I hate the most when we're talking about a universe that's supposed to be established and we already kind of know who the characters are. In this case, the subject being Star Trek. For the second movie to be successful, we're going to have to see the characters expanded upon and those relationships that had just been put together or started in the first movie be expanded upon and see where they're at now, these characters. And just kind of move on from there. You know, less lens flare wouldn't be a bad place to start either.
Yeah.
As far as just making it a successful movie, period, I think. So, as for what would be considered a terrible Star Trek movie, doing the opposite of what it just said. You know, if it's just another space adventure action flick with a Star Trek skin over it, that's going to make it a bad Star Trek movie. Because at that point, it's just a sci-fi movie is all it is. So,
I wouldn't even call it sci-fi at that point. I would just call it space adventure.
J.J. Abrams.
Space adventure.
Space adventure.
Yeah, I mean, if it's the line between like what is sci-fi and what isn't is obviously blurry, and there's a lot of argument to be had over it. But I feel like if you aren't using, if you're so like, if your physics are so weird and strange that they aren't using any kind of real science and are basically just magic, and you could replace the spaceships with horses and the and the technology with wizards and not lose anything, that doesn't really feel like sci-fi to me anymore. I think that's just a space adventure. Space adventures can be fine. But it's sometimes Star Trek is space adventure. Like, Star Trek isn't always science fiction, in my opinion. But I like it when it is. Grace, you want to go?
I think my definition of what would make it a successful Star Trek movie is probably a little looser, just as long as it still ties into what we've established, but at the same time shows respect for the older subject matter while being an entertaining movie, that'll be enough for me. If it was a terrible movie, I could probably get a lot more creative with what could make it terrible. They could just insert some more space whales or...
Hey, come on. Everyone loves space whales. You're not allowed
to... Yeah, I'd like to see less
I'm kidding.
Of
I'm just
the...
saying there's a time and a place for space whales.
I'd like to see less of the modern military uniforms that they seem to be introducing more and more of in these newer Star Trek films. Yeah, it's just, that's not an aesthetic that I think fits so much with this. I mean, it kind of worked a little bit with Enterprise, kind of with their NASA jumpsuit thing that they had going on, because that time period was a little closer to what we've got going on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry?
They're like coveralls?
Yeah.
It's kind of what they were.
Yeah, well, that kind of made a little more sense in Enterprise, and that's kind of something that I don't have a problem with, is kind of how their outfits were. But you know, the ones that are that I've seen in, you know, 2009, and then this new one that's coming out this year in May, very much remind me of, you know, just like Air Force, you know, like a lot of kind of dress, you know, Air Force type attire, and it kind of bothers me that that's the aesthetic that they want to go with. And I understand that it's recognizable as being, these guys are a military force, look at them go. But I mean, like, Star Trek has already a very well-established aesthetic, especially for this time period that we're talking about here, which is the original series time period, you know, from what is with now with the first 2009 movie being 2258 to wherever they're going to be in the second movie. And we already know what the uniforms are.
Yeah.
You know? We have a very good idea what the uniforms are. You know,
we can just consider it a stylistic update for now, and we could argue aesthetics till we all get turned blue in the face. But,
well, also, yeah. I'm not convinced that they're actually going to be wearing anything other than the traditional blue, gold, and red, because I've seen some photos, but, like, I think those are, from what I can tell, those are, like, undershirts. Like, I've seen them with the black uniform, yeah. But I don't think that's a uniform. I think that's what they have on underneath the colored shirt.
Maybe they've all gone rogue.
Like, you know, maybe that's what they wear when they're not on duty or whatever. But all the actual, like, you know, footage, like all the trailer footage that I've seen, for the most part, they're wearing the normal uniform. So, you know, there were those weird screenshots of them in what looked like wetsuits. But without knowing any more context,
they're
I can't...
They're space wetsuits.
Yeah, I mean, without knowing more context, I can't really tell you what that was about. For me, in order for it to be a successful, I could just categorize that as it makes a lot of money. I suppose that would make it successful. But in order for me to consider it good, it would have to have a plot that makes sense. Because, you know, I'm not against the, you know, it being an action movie. I like action movies just fine. And I'm okay with it. My problem with the first one wasn't that it was an action movie, it was that it was a stupid action movie. It had a really dumb plot that made no sense whatsoever and was like, you know, felt like it was trying to be science fiction, but was just ended up being stupid. And so the only reason I liked the first movie was because of the characters. I really liked a lot of the characterization. So if this one has a better villain and a better plot, which it looks like it might, I mean, at least it looks like it's got a better villain, assuming Benedict Cumberbatch
detonated the fleet.
Yeah, I mean, okay, that's a really stupid plot synopsis, but, you know, we have no idea. We don't know what that means. And assuming Benedict Cumberbatch is actually the villain, and, you know, that might not actually be true, there's still, like, this mystery character being played by somebody else. And I've heard it theorized that Benedict Cumberbatch is his just his sidekick. But, frankly, we won't know until we actually see the gosh darn movie.
Yeah, it's probably too early to tell.
But if, you know, it looks like they've got a better villain, and if the story makes more sense and doesn't, you know, involve black holes that sometimes take you back in time and sometimes destroy you, you know, that...
plot convenience.
Yeah, I'll be okay werewolves. With that, you know.
A plot hole, if you will.
Oh,
man. No, that's an interesting idea, actually. Just kind of what you're thinking about. So think about it. If if the black hole hadn't destroyed the Narada, right, Nero's ship, we could totally have a series just based on the time-traveling space adventures of Nero.
I would watch the hell out of that.
Yeah, it turns out he wasn't actually...
This totally angry, bitter Romulan who's just like, with this Borgified up mining ship just tooling around the galaxy. Yeah.
Yeah, he got like...
We could call it Nero Trek.
I would prefer not to call it that, but I suppose we could. Yeah, I mean, you know, we could just have a spin-off series. It's like, oh, it turns out that black hole just took him back in time like every other black hole did. It also took the planet Vulcan back in time. You know, Vulcan's just hanging out, you know, like 500 years ago or what have you.
It's going to take them back to, like, a pre-warp era, and they're just going to be left wandering around empty space.
Although, you know, it would have had...
This is totally like a redo, then, for Nero, because he gets sucked into the hole, right?
Maybe this is a chance to re-examine my deeds in life.
Because he's been thrown back further in time, he's got a redo now, right? Because and also, he has even less opposition. So now in another alternate reality. So now we're on third generational reality now with Nero, right? Because he had the first prime one, then he went to this alternate one now that he made.
And now he's back further.
But now he's back further. There's a different alternate reality now.
This is like Inception. We are like just going further and further into alternate reality dreamland.
And I'm getting more and more lost.
I hate these time travel stories and alternate reality crap so much.
Yep. All right. So this next email is from it's from Data Logan, and it, as you can tell, it is not short. So let's get to it. Naming conventions for planets. I always assumed the names we hear on Star Trek are English translations of the actual names of planets/stars or the human/Federation names. I assume the natives of a planet would have different names and very possibly many different names. You remember Malachor 3 from the TNG episode First Contact and how the natives of that planet thought their world was the center of the universe? Really, you think you're the center of the universe, but you put a 3 in the name of your world? I don't think so. That must just be the Federation name for the world that we heard because of the universal translators. Bajor is apparently actually called Bajor by the Bajoran people, but maybe that's just because the writers weren't imaginative enough. In the books, the star of the Bajoran system is called Bahavel. Bahavel? Bahavel?
Is that Hebrew?
No, but it does have a lot of glottal stops in it. And as he recalls, Earth has occasionally been referred to as Sol 3, which I think would be hilarious. I agree with Oren, yeah you do, that we should be more optimistic about future alien contact. It's not a foregone conclusion that we'll all get ground under by advanced alien visitors. I believe the idea that any aliens who have the resources and technology and desire to get here and visit us would already be beyond the need to conquer us and steal our measly stuff, especially since we are learning that Earth-like planets may not be as rare in the galaxy as we once thought, or so says my wife.
Well, NASA did recently say, I mean, as they often do, they announced, oh man, we found this thing out in space. You guys should be impressed. They were saying that they've found a planet around, what was it, like a dwarf star or something like that, where it's the orbit of it, I think, is considerably closer, but the Goldilocks zone of it is still there for that star, and it has potential for supporting life and being Earth-like as well.
Yeah, well, I agree. I mean, it's like, what could these aliens possibly get from Earth that they couldn't get from a lot of other places? Unless, I think as I pointed out last week, unless they really need fossil fuels. Because, you know, you need life for those. But other than that, like, all the resources are going to be everywhere else. Bob brought forth the idea that visiting aliens might be capable of transferring to a different vessel if their body dies. This actually reminds me of a good idea for a version of space exploration. Our scientists have yet to figure out a way for people/ships/mass travel to neighboring alien systems faster than light, but we have already found ways to send small amounts of information faster than light. This has been done using 2 subatomic particles that are quantum linked, meaning that when you can change the state of the one, the other state changes immediately, regardless of the distance in between. This is a minor note for me. I think this is referred to in shorthand as quantum entanglement. Scientists have taken particles like this, separated them by significant distance, changed the state of one, and then the other changed state in less time than it would have taken light to travel from one to the other. So you can transfer one bit of information faster than light. So if you could set up a ton of those, you could theoretically transfer information instantly. So assuming we can perfect the ability to send significant amounts of information long distances reliably at FTL, it leaves us a good way to explore other planets, send droid bodies controlled by FTL signals from Earth. It may take hundreds of years for our droid bodies to get there, but once we're there, we could have instantaneous communication. Plus, if the droid bodies were to be destroyed, we wouldn't be hurt. We'd just activate another droid body. Maybe even think of it as transferring to a different vessel. Although, come on, Data Logan. We all know that if you die in the game, you die for real. I'm going to summarize a little bit of the rest because it's an interesting breakdown of various things that Alpha Centauri various things that have been contradicted like by canon, because there have been it's a branch off from our Alpha Centauri conversation, and he lists a bunch of examples of when the non-canon stuff like the books has established something and then canon has completely wiped out of existence. So I like it. There's a lot of cool stuff in here, but if I read it, we would be here all day. So I'm gonna skip down to the bottom where we keep talking about Alpha Centauri. Why would Alpha Centauri be considered a separate signing member, but not Mars or Pajem, or other planets that have been clearly colonized by the Federation member worlds? This is in response to me last week wondering why if Alpha Centauri was a Federation colony, it seems to be the canon explanation why it's considered a founding member. Bob says maybe that's just because we don't care about non-human colony worlds, because Bob's jaded. or racist. I think it probably has more to do with a political relationship. Probably Alpha Centauri was a fully independent system, previously colonized by humans, while Mars, colonized in 2103 according to Voyager's 37s, but maybe not independent prior to 2161, and the Moon, or Pajem, and, what's this one? Waitan et al. What is that? Waitan? I assume that's
Waitan
another...
Waitan et al.
I assume that must be another colony, but I'm forgetting where that's from.
Waitan, that was the planet that the Andorians and Vulcans were fighting over.
Is that what that was?
In Enterprise.
Okay. Yep. Good save, Bob. Or small.
I think the Andorians were the ones who called it Waitan, I think.
Yeah. Other small independent colonies who would become members of the Federation by default once the parent planets do. It's interesting how we colonize further out, Terra Nova and Alpha Centauri, before we colonize closer, but harder to colonize worlds like Mars or Titan. Yes, that is interesting.
Terraforming's a hard business, man.
Yeah, terraforming's hard, although by the same token, I feel like it would make more sense to establish, you know, contained environments on Mars before we sent out ship all the way to Terra Nova. But, you know, nothing about the Terra Nova story makes any sense, so, you know, what have you. I wonder how Federation members are represented. Often it seems like every race within the Federation has equal representation on the Federation Council, etc. But then how do you deal with crossbreeds? Who is their representative? And what about people of one race, say Andorians, who have chosen to take up residency on another planet, say Deneb, that is populated almost entirely by humans? Who is their proper representative? Sometimes it seems like each planet gets its own representative. There was a Marshallan Counselor in the Genesis Wave, Book 1. That would make sense and would take care of all the questions about who represents half-breeds, etc. Yeah, I always just assumed that there was one representative from each planet. Like, that would make sense to me.
Democratically, it would, yeah.
Yeah, maybe, and, I mean, maybe you might want, if it's a really big planet, maybe it would get two, I don't know. But I would assume each planet gets one vote on the Federation Council. That just makes sense to me. In the United States, we have a, bicameral? What is that?
Bicameral.
Grace? Bicameral Congress. The two different legislative chambers within Congress use different rules to determine who is representing whom. One is done by population, the House of Representatives, and one is done by the government/state affiliation, the Senate. The idea is that the two chambers will focus on the same legislature from different points of view, one purely by common man population and one by government alignment. But in the Federation, in addition to having to worry about the population numbers and the government/planetary system affiliation, you also need to worry about race. Because there are certainly going to be legislative issues that run along race lines. Maybe the Federation has a trimerical legislative body. That would be interesting. You have your House of Representatives, which is representative, which like different planets with more populations have more representatives in it. You have your Federation Council, which has one representative from each planet. And then you would have like your third body, which would have like one representative from each member race. That would be interesting.
It would be complicated.
I tend to think the Federation might go with the simpler approach of just having one representative from each planet. And even if you're a human, if you're from a planet that has an Andorian population, you have to, you know, take their needs into account, too.
Probably. That's kind of what we have to do with people who immigrate and are of, you know, mixed heritage families here on Earth. So,
yeah,
why
I mean,
not?
And that is kind of a problem that we have nowadays. You have places where... There's like, say, you know, say a Hispanic population like is 20% of the general population of a state, but only 5% of the government is made up of Hispanics.
Yeah.
That's kind of a problem.
Proper representation is probably a problem even in the future.
Yeah. Bob, what do you think?
The thought I'm having here with this particular bit of the email with how the Federation is governed is it seems to be that there are these nation states that are unified by a common cause. I really think the Federation could really be more looked at, you know, how the United States is formed as opposed to how, like, the United Nations is formed, I think, in terms of how their government works.
Yeah, that's fair. All right, Bob, why don't you read the next email because I'm getting tired.
All right, so this is from Samuel Truman.
Wait,
he
entitled
it.
Hang on. He would prefer to be known as Sampo.
Oh, okay. Sampo. Mr. Sampo. All right, so. Well, there you go. It's in the first line of the thing.
Yeah.
Put it in the subject line from now on, because I'm not going to know that until I get in the email. All right, so howdy, y'all. I'd really be interested in your review of Fleet Captains. I came across that when I was looking into the Magic the Gathering and Star Trek CCG cards from 1995. Don't judge. I'm not. I'm certainly not. I was into Star Trek CCG.
I have some of those. I don't think we ever figured out how to play them, but I had some.
It's actually kind of a fun game. It wasn't too difficult.
Focus.
And found both board games you mentioned plus another one. It's also called the Star Trek Customizable Card Game because it has dice. For the love of the prophets, I don't know why. Not sure why they would name it the same thing, but separate from the old one. That kind of brings me to another point. I bought the Magic the Gathering video game recently, and the game seems legit. There are cool things like special effects when creatures attack or other various cards get played. The decks are pre-made, but apparently you can buy more and mix them. Well, that got me thinking, what if someone made a pimp virtual version of Star Trek CCG? It sounds silly since it's like, why play a virtual card game when you can play something like Sto or some other Star Trek game? Well, there is something to be said about gameplay and strategy that you can get with card games, but not so much with regular video games. Plus, you could play with others that aren't in your immediate area, and you wouldn't have to worry about keeping space for all your cards. Mm-hmm. What do you guys think? Would it be something that you'd be interested in? Should the all-powerful Star Trek gods will it into existence? Sampo.
Well, I mean, it would depend on... I would have to like the game first. Like I said, I never actually figured out how to play the old Star Trek CCG. We just had some of the cards. So if it was a good game... Sure. Like, I mean, I actually really enjoy playing the Magic card video game thing, because, like, it can be kind of cool. It can take care of a lot of, like, you know, you don't have to move all your cards around every time you want to play somebody. It's got cool graphics, you know, stuff like that. And it would be fun for me to play. Plus, it would be nice for me to have a multiplayer Star Trek game I can play with other people that isn't Star Trek Online.
Yeah. It'd be nice to have an alternative to that. Why not? That's my official stance right there. Why not?
Bob, you have an opinion?
Yeah. I guess not really. I guess I'm kind of indifferent to the idea, I suppose, of a virtual Star Trek CCG, I guess. I mean, you know, like I played the card game. The card game was pretty cool, you know, and such. But I don't think the card game would compete on the same level as, like, Star Trek Online or other Star Trek game, as Sampo suggests in the email.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's a totally different... I think it's something that would appeal to people who play CCGs and not so much that would appeal to someone who watches Star Trek.
Yeah, I mean, the CCG...
Or plays Star Trek video games.
The CCG would have to be popular already, and then you could make it into a video game. It wouldn't really...
Which is why we have Magic the Gathering as a video game, which does it very well. There is, as far as I can tell anyway, I've only played it a couple times on the Xbox... But the Magic the Gathering, game, you know, is pretty much the card game. It's just done, you know, on a video screen instead of, you know, with actual cards and such on the table.
Well, that's fair. All right, so we move on to our next email?
Sure, that's a thing we can do, I suppose. See here. So this actually, we get two of them from Christopher13.
Uh-oh.
Unless he wants me to call him something else. All right, so to Bob, Grace, and Oren. I pretty much enjoyed the episode where you discussed Star Trek Phase 2 fan series. I'd like to at least address one of the main points that was brought up, but before I do, there's one small thing mentioned that I have to address. Uh-oh. He has to address something here. You know, things have gotten serious when Chris is starting to say that he has to address something.
Well, he can't not address it. He has to.
Somebody has to.
Someone has to, I guess it's his job. I have to wonder why everyone was surprised why Oren was ready to give a free pass on Phase 2's pilot episode. If memory serves me, I figured this would be an email at some point. If memory serves me right, I believe he said something similar in episode 60 of this podcast when he had taken off his Oren mask to speak in his Chuck Sonnenberg voice identity as to why he normally wouldn't review fan films in his video reviews. Given that, I'm not surprised at the pass given here in his Oren alter ego. I'm not sure if he changed his mind since then on reviewing them in his video reviews when in his Chuck Sonnenberg identity, but I digress. One of the things discussed was the scene in the episode Blood and Fire that Oren mentioned where Kirk was surprised at his nephew wanting Kirk to marry him and his partner. It's been a while since I've seen any of the Phase 2 episodes, but when I first watched it some time ago, my reaction was basically similar to Oren's. Though, as I later thought about it, I wondered perhaps the surprise Kirk had was not towards him his nephew wanted to marry, but the fact that Peter wanted to get married then. Perhaps Kirk was thinking that maybe his nephew was probably going a little too fast in his life. Alexanderification, jokes aside, Peter is a part of Kirk's family, after all, And there's probably a few uncles or aunts out there in the world in similar situations who may or may not feel that way. Well, you know, I like the use of the word Alexanderification.
They grow up so fast.
Can we
put that into our lexicon now?
Alexanderification? Is that just what happens when someone ages too quickly?
I thought that was like causification or something.
It's like, I thought you were two.
Weren't you a baby last episode?
Maybe Kirk was also fast enough to think that maybe... Wait a minute. Was also fast enough to think that maybe Peter might be too sensitive to how he was wording things and caught himself. The scene does certainly look that way, but it could also be that he's still a bit shocked about his nephew wanting to get married all of a sudden. All the thoughts about why Peter wanted to get married all of a sudden and why Kirk, of all people, was the one chosen by his nephew as a person to marry him off. Well, that was because he would just happen to be the captain of the ship.
Yeah, convenience. Remember,
Peter's decision being on the ship had nothing to do with his uncle being the captain and everything to do with the fact that his, you know, significant other was on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. It was just happened to be Captain Kirk who was in charge of that ship. That's it. After watching Blood and Fire for the first time, I recall seeing posts on a forum, I can't recall which, about how some felt it looked like Kirk may have been a little bothered about his nephew wanting to marry another man, and how un-Roddenberry-like it seemed, but it wasn't clear. When I watched that episode, it seemed clear enough to me that Kirk wasn't bothered about that at all, and I felt that it was reinforced by it being such a non-issue in the episode itself, and by Kirk's care for Peter that even showed in the following episode, Enemy Starfleet, when Kirk talked to Peter in a very good moment of that episode. But again, I have seen any Phase 2 episodes recently, so my analysis could be off here. In any case, I enjoyed episode 78. Though she appeared as a guest in prior episodes, Grace was certainly enjoyable as a new host, as she made me laugh. While Bob and Oren can certainly make an episode of gross entertaining enough to listen to, Grace definitely helped me make episode 78 one of the most memorable episodes. I think I may soon consider this podcast to be the one I look forward to most to listen to. Thank you, and all the best to the three of you. Sincerely, Chris.
Because we're the best.
Yeah.
All right, hold on. I need to increase my ego a few notches.
I think my ego that needs attention right now. I mean, hello. Look at this. That's practically a glowing review.
All right.
Yeah. So we got another one actually from Chris as well that he's sent in. If you wanted to send this in, 104. So he's getting it just under the wire. And it's titled "On the Topic of Uniforms." To Grace, Bob, and Oren.
I'm at the front of the name list!
Which is weird, because Bob is like should come first because of the alphabetical order, but whatever. You keep going, Bob.
Chris 13 just does what he wants.
He does, apparently.
He doesn't play by your rules.
Yeah. My wish to bring this topic up again came when I was listening to the reply of Data Logan's letter and uniforms were brought up. Although the point about uniforms was more towards the topic of when Star Trek First Contact took place in the TNG DS9... Voyager, I'm assuming that's supposed to be Voyager, which is B-O-Y, not V-G-R. I want to address Bob's observation about how there's been a mixture of uniforms around this time, and Oren's point of how it seems the uniforms are introduced in phases. This is basically true, and while it certainly makes little sense in Star Trek Generations, it makes a lot more sense in DS9. Around the first few seasons, the type of uniforms worn on DS9 seem to be mainly for space stations such as Deep Space Nine, and perhaps others, while the type of uniform seen during TNG are still worn by attachés to Federation colonies, such as Lieutenant Commander Cal Hudson, high-ranking officers such as admirals like Nechayev, personnel of Starfleet HQ, as seen in DS9's Homefront and Paradise Lost, and crews of larger starships, such as the Enterprise and Odyssey. The TNG type of uniform was even worn by Admiral Hayes at the beginning of First Contact. That's actually true, it was.
Is it? Really?
The impression I get... The impression I get from that is that the DS9 type of uniform is a more utilitarian type of uniform meant for normal duties, while the TNG type was increasingly becoming a uniform for duties more administrative in nature. Starfleet has always had uniforms for different roles, regardless of how inconsistent the uses of such uniforms. After all, there have been dress uniforms for formal occasions, utilitarian jumpsuits and hazmat suits for engineering duties, and, although on rare occasion, field jackets for away teams.
Field jackets. They have the magical power of pockets.
There can be windbreakers. It could be windy down on the planet.
Don't forget to bring your parka.
Wear a jacket. It's cold out in space.
And I seem to get the impression from almost every Trek fan that there's usually only one or two uniforms for certain occasions, and that's it. While Starfleet isn't a military organization according to Picard, except when it's mentioned as being won by David Marcus, it seems to me that our militaries of the real world use different types of uniforms and dress for certain occasions. Mm-hmm. Heck, this is even practiced civilian life. Casual attire when not at work, a tie and jacket for weddings or business occasions, etc. In a previous letter of Data Logan's, he mentioned some of the other Star Trek fan productions out there, one of which being Star Trek Intrepid, which places its story in the TNG movie era. And some of the episodes of that fan production, both TNG and TNG movie uniforms are based with a rationale similar to the one that I've given my above paragraph. So at least I'm not alone in this line of thinking. In any case, what are your thoughts on this subject? Whatever the reply will be, I'd like to thank the three of you. All the best to you guys and gal. Sincerely, Chris.
Okay, well, I don't think I can... I think I'm going to end up retreading a little bit of ground here. But basically, I sort of agree. I think that, for the most part, different uniforms aren't necessarily, like, a continuity error. Like, it seemed pretty clear to me that the Deep Space Nine uniforms they were wearing were, like, station personnel uniforms. Especially because, like, when the TNG crew show up a few times later in the show, they're still wearing the normal TNG uniforms, and the Deep Space Nine characters are wearing their uniforms. So, you know, I just, you know, I assumed that that's the way it was supposed to be, and that maybe, like, maybe even that Starfleet was considering switching all of its people over to the Deep Space Nine uniforms, but they were testing it first to see how it worked.
They're testing it out in deep space.
Yeah, they're beta testing, you know? they're recording feedback and, you know, making patches and fixing balance issues, things like that.
I don't see why they wouldn't have, you know, different uniforms for different branches and different groups. Why not?
Yeah, I mean, the only time it really bothered me was in Generations when they had the different uniforms on the same ship. It was like they had never used the Deep Space Nine uniforms on the Enterprise before, and then suddenly in Generations they were, and it was like, what's going on here? Do you guys run out of costumes? Like, is that why this is happening?
I wouldn't be surprised, actually.
Well, like, I heard that they originally wanted to switch over to the Deep Space Nine uniforms, and I can't cite a source, but I heard that they wanted to switch to the Deep Space Nine uniforms because the TNG uniforms on the big screen, their zippers were really obvious. But that doesn't explain why some of them were still wearing TNG uniforms.
They're making a slow transition over from one uniform to the next. Who knows?
That just seems silly.
You can't have zippers in the 24th century. That's obviously a fashion taboo, is to have zippers in,
well,
in
the future. Really,
you get transported into your uniform.
I really hate zippers. So, you know, I prefer... I would much prefer the buttons myself.
Nah. Zippers all the way, man.
It did kind of bother me that Voyager didn't switch over to the later Deep Space Nine uniforms when they reestablished contact with the Alpha Quadrant. Just because that, I think, would have been something they would have done if they were trying to, you know, reestablish we are, in fact, part of the Federation. We aren't just a ship out, you know, desperately trying to survive. But I guess that would have probably been expensive and maybe confused people. They would have, you know, if you missed the one episode where they explain why they're wearing the new uniforms and suddenly it's like, why is everyone wearing new uniforms? What's going on?
What's happening?
But I mean, like, because they kept switching between what kind of phasers they were using. So I, you know, I didn't think uniforms would be that big a deal, but apparently I was wrong. But other than that, I mean... Like, the shift from the TMP uniforms into the Wrath of Khan uniforms is a little bit sudden, but I don't care, because I hate the TMP uniforms, so I'm willing to give them that one. It's also a little strange that they apparently used the Wrath of Khan uniforms for, like, something like nearly a century, like, the time it, you know, I forget exactly when Wrath of Khan takes place, but they used them from at least Wrath of Khan up until when the Enterprise C was destroyed.
Really? No fashion updates? An entire century?
Well, because
they took away the white collar went away.
Right. I guess, yeah, they did that, but it's still basically the same uniform, whereas, like, in TNG, the Deep Space Nine TNG era, they go through, like, three different uniform changes.
That was just a really fashion-conscious era, I guess.
Yeah, there was, I mean, some places do employ, you know, professional fashion designers to make their uniforms.
Yeah, like flight attendants.
Apparently that's a big thing in Italy right now.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that's kind of cool.
They look fabulous.
Law Pro makes my uniforms.
I don't know. Uniforms is one of those things that normally I'm okay with. I will normally let a lot of stuff slide, except in Star Trek Online. I don't like how in Star Trek Online you can wear like a TOS uniform. That bothers me.
There is no uniform option at all for Star Trek Online. It's all just costume. That's all it is Star Trek Online. There's no uniform.
Everyone wears something weird and different. Can I wear my environmental suit on the bridge? Is that a thing I'm allowed to do? Wear my Cardassian space suit?
Yes, that's a thing you can do.
That's probably what I would do. All right. Anything else we want to say about this email?
Thanks for writing.
It's an email. It takes up some server space somewhere. In this particular case, on the Hotmail servers that we use for our email, allthingstrek@hotmail.com.
Yeah,
you can continue to send us more emails and berate us on certain points. Let us know why we're wrong or why we're correct in certain regards, and how awesome Grace is as one of our new co-hosts.
Yay.
So please send emails to allthingstrek@hotmail.com.
Okay, so we have a main topic of the show to get to, and Grace, this was your idea.
Yep.
So from last week, we mentioned that it was going to be Star Trek as a part of kitsch culture, and the question we got was, what is kitsch culture? Explain yourself, Grace.
Kitsch culture originally originated, if I can be so redundant, from the idea of being overly dramatic, overly sentimental. It's a German-ish word for something that's been mass-produced and made so it will be just, you know, widely spread and popular. Look it up on Wikipedia if you don't believe me. It's a thing.
The image on Wikipedia is, like, the primary image on the article is a cat with a, like, one of those fancy white frill collars things.
How do you spell kitsch? Kitsch culture.
K-I-T-S-C-H. Kitsch.
Kitsch culture. I'm doing this live. We're at the Wikipedia thing here.
And I'm just looking at kitsch. It. And I was looking at this picture on Wikipedia, and I see this cat, and I'm like, wait, what century is that from? Because according to this, it's from the 19th century, and I was like, were cats in artwork a thing before
the
internet?
Well, the idea was for it to appeal to an over-sentimentality in art. Like, mm-hmm. Lots of flowers, lots of lovey-dovey, lots of doe-eyed little children and stuff like that, and pretty much just... Originally, it meant sappiness for the sake of popularity, like how we post cats for instant internet karma. But it came to sort of evolve into this sort of...
Someone's a Redditor.
What? But it came to evolve into this...
Oh, no, it's cool, it's cool. I browse Reddit frequently while I'm at work.
It came to evolve into this sense of ironic anti-culture, like adults who watched Pee-wee's Playhouse during the 80s, they considered that kitsch. Like old school, bad TV, bad movies, that's kitsch.
What about when Lillian watches Pee-wee's Playhouse like right now? Does
she watches it with genuine enthusiasm.
So that's not kitsch though.
We'll get to that later.
Oh, okay, alright.
So anyway, kitsch and the camp culture, when it's campy, you know it's over the top. You make fun of it for being over the top. And Star Trek is pretty over the top, at least in the original series, definitely.
I've definitely described the original series as being campy on more than one occasion.
Oh, definitely.
Although sometimes I get into like a confused discussion over what exactly campy means. Like sometimes like I didn't realize this, but sometimes people imply that campiness is like associated with gay culture somehow. Which,
not necessarily.
Yeah, I didn't think so, but that's like a thing that people think campy means.
The gays are trying to take camp back, I guess.
They can't have
the
it. It's
gays.
Fine. The gays can't have camp.
There's a set group of them.
Of the gays. But anyway.
Not necessarily. Like, there are lots of things that are just kind of camp because they're over the top and melodramatic. Like, Buffy is considered to be really was considered campy when it came out.
There are certainly a lot of Buffy episodes I would consider campy.
Yeah.
Like Spock's brain is pretty campy.
We'll get to that later, yeah.
Okay. So what do you...
That's so good.
How do you want to start off this conversation?
Well, how do we think that Star Trek became part of a sort of modern sense of kitsch culture and... Let's go from there.
Okay.
Why do people consider it kitschy? What makes it campy?
Well, I mean, some of it, a lot of that would be, like, especially from in, like, the original series, a lot of that is stuff that's just sort of a sign of the times,
yeah.
Right? Like, when it was made. Mm-hmm. So it's hard for me to consider if that would be kitsch or not. But I would definitely consider a lot of early TNG to be very kitsch.
Oh, definitely.
Because it was very similar in style to TOS, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, heck, SF Debris just did a review today of The Skin of Evil where he talked about how it's another, you know, one of the basic TOS stories with a modern cast.
Yeah.
And everything has, like, I don't know if you got, but if you just watch an early, like, a season one TOS episode, just look at the color scheme. It feels like something from the 60s.
Yeah, it feels like they're trying to emulate it, and they were trying a little too hard.
Yeah, and you have, like, some, like, and it's, like, also the style of dialogue. Like,
yeah.
It's sometimes kind of hard to put into words, but in TOS, you would very often have these sort of very, like, I don't know, not quite grandiose, but very bold statements that the characters would make that, you know, as the audience, you're kind of like, really? And you would wonder about that. And they wouldn't really explain it because they would just assume you agreed with them. And like...
like I'm saying, over the top and overly dramatic.
Right, and you did that all the time in first season TOS. I don't know if I would consider... I think Code of Honor just starts to go into racism right there. But, I mean, like, you remember that sequence in Code of Honor when Tasha Yar and... Deanna Troi and Picard are giving Tasha Yar a hard time, and like because they and talking about how she's totally become attracted to this guy, and it's like, what, really? Why?
Is that really any of your business?
Well, it is, and like, why would you even think that? It's just so silly.
Well, Deanna Troi can tell empathy.
Apparently, she can tell.
She can tell when you've got the hots for someone, which would make her like the world's worst drinking buddy, I guess.
Oh,
yeah.
Although you know,
like him.
I had completely forgotten that Deanna Troi played a really important role in The Skin of Evil. Like, yeah. I remembered her being like mostly unconscious in the shuttle, but apparently that's just not how it happened. It's been a while since I've seen that episode.
It's because you've seen so much bad Deanna Troi, you can't see her any other way.
That kind of starts
why is because your vision of Deanna Troi has been so colored because of the rest of the presentation that you can't accept that there might have been a good presentation at one point. Only once, mind you, but it happened.
It all kind of bleeds together. If it's not the face of the enemy, it's all the same.
Another thing about first season of TNG, there's a whole lot of matte painting backgrounds, aren't there?
Yeah, there really are. They don't do a whole lot of exterior shots in TNG. Like, they did one, they did, in early TNG, they had, like, a Code of Justice, I think.
Yeah.
Which, or maybe it's just Justice, not Code of Justice, it's just Justice.
Just Justice.
Yeah.
Code of Justice.
Justice!
It's just Justice. And that's an exterior shot. That's like some kind of water treatment plant, yeah. I think.
But they're, like, outdoors and near a weirdly colored sunset a lot, it feels like, during first season of TNG.
And they have that really silly-looking, like, rock planet in yeah. The Last Outpost.
Yeah. Stuff like that. That there is pretty damn kitschy.
Now, I've always... does kitschy relate to merchandising at all?
It can, yeah.
Because I've always sort of seen, like... For some reason, I've seen, like, big banks of, like, terrible-looking Star Trek action figures, and yeah. Been like, that's pretty kitschy.
Yeah.
And I've always said that without really knowing what it meant.
Well, sometimes a word just kind of takes on a life of its own like that. But yeah, that's pretty kitschy.
Like, I've got a giant box back in Hawaii of these really terrible Star Trek action figures. you know, I saved some of the better ones, but most of them are just like, these are awful. I don't know why anyone would make these.
Yeah, it goes as part of the sort of so bad it's good culture, or also part of the liking things ironically, which actually... brings us to the next topic.
Yeah, okay.
I'm mumbling now.
No, that's a good idea. Instead of, since we've got a couple of minutes till the top of the hour, why don't we take a music break and then we will come back and continue with the topic.
This is a thing that we can do.
Make it happen, Bob.
Make it so.
Hang on, I gotta align the nacelles here a little bit. Hang on.
I hate it when the nacelles get unaligned. You know, there's a lot
that's
of...
True. The nacelles themselves are unaligned right now. I have to align them right now.
That's a phrase.
There's empty space in the nacelle, according to Enterprise.
Yeah, well, if you need somewhere to hide, I suppose that's the place to do it.
You're listening to the podcast and archive of all things Trek. Music breaks have been cut out due to copyright reasons. If you'd like to hear the music, please tune in live Saturday 1 to 3 Pacific Time on Trek Radio.
And welcome back to All Things Trek here on TrekRadio.net. I'm Bob.
And I'm Oren.
And I'm Grace.
Woo!
Yay! We're awesome.
So there, it's true. So as you probably heard at the beginning of this episode, you probably didn't if you're listening live, because then you're listening in right now, or if you just tuned in right now on the live stream, you wouldn't have heard it. But if you're listening to the archive, you also know that we do emails at the front of this show, because we're cooler than other podcasts, and we decided that, hey, you know, we don't want people to not get their stuff read on the air, and we want to be able to answer your questions and your feedback or snide remarks or maybe potentially death threats. That thankfully I haven't gotten yet so far, but I look forward to the day that we do so I can...
Fingers crossed.
The police process. Fingers crossed for death threats. Exactly, that's right. In Grace's case, at least, anyway.
Hey.
So if you'd like to send us an email, please send it to allthingstrek@hotmail.com. We'll go ahead and read it on the air at the front end of the show, mind you, so you can tune in real quick, listen to your email being read, and then turn it off immediately so you can just get that out of the way. Because I don't like wasting your time. We don't want you to, you know, have to worry about, you know, your precious time being used in a manner that you don't appreciate. That's why we do the emails at the front.
Yeah, I made the decision to do the emails at the front of the show.
We made the decision to do the emails at the front.
I thought it was my idea. But do I get nothing?
No, it wasn't.
Focus.
For so many.
Well, as I recall, we made that decision just because it's kind of lame if you send in an email and you're really excited, and then, like, they get to the end of the show and, like, oh, we have no time to read all the emails. That's too bad.
We're making you a priority because we're that accommodating.
Mm-hmm. So I know that's happened to me a couple of times. So I've sent emails to other shows, and then, like, they get to the end, and they're like, you know, they read it really quick, and they're like, well, now we have to go. And then they leave. I'm like, oh, that's sad.
So Oren's tragedy is the listener's gain.
Well, I just want to make sure that people are aware that All Things Trek is a beacon and a paragon of society. We're champions of the people, you know, so. At least amongst the podcasting culture.
Is that what we are? Okay.
We're cultured. Wow.
All right. So now that we're back, I wanted to, in relation to our discussion of Star Trek as part of kitsch culture, I wanted to talk about episodes that we enjoy, you know, either ironically or even though we know they're bad or really silly.
Yeah.
And there are more than a few of those. I think for me, one of the ones that kind of comes to mind is Move Along Home, which is actually a Deep Space Nine episode. And for anyone who doesn't remember that, it's the episode where they make first contact with this race called the Wadi. And, you know, with a name like the Wadi, they really should have known better. But they get, the Wadi are all about games, and they transport Sisko, Dax, Kira, and Bashir into one of their games, and they have to do a lot of really silly stuff. And I mean,
they have to play hopscotch at one point.
Yeah, and sing a silly sounding song. And you just listen to the way that the actors are singing it, and they're like, really? We have to do this?
Their suffering is what makes it entertaining.
Yeah, and it's kind of, I mean, it's definitely not an episode that I feel is essential to the show
in any way. No.
And it's like, but it's kind of, you know, now that I have, since I like Deep Space Nine a lot, like, watching it is kind of funny because I get to see Odo, like, really ineffectually trying to investigate stuff. He's like, I have no idea what's going on. And he has his, like, his really dweeby security assistant guy who was only in two episodes. And he's like, you know, he's like, why didn't you report it when none of the senior officers showed up for their shifts? And the guy's like, oh, I heard they were at a kickin' party last night. And it was like, since when is that an excuse?
Priorities. Priorities.
It's like, I don't usually get the day off just because I went to a kickin' party and have a hangover. I have to go to work, whatever.
Yeah, but you're not upper management, though.
I suppose that's
also
true.
Also, you're not Starfleet.
Maybe Starfleet has an alien first contact clause where they're, no, well, it's not even that they're allowed to skip work. It's that he didn't even think it was strange. It was like, no one is here. It's probably fine.
It's all good.
No, it's cool, bro. It's cool, bro. It's all right.
That's what we should name that assistant. We should call him Ensign Saul Good.
I think he was a lieutenant.
Lieutenant, you know, Saul Good.
You know, it's like, I'm pretty sure this was after the episode that they had where the station just randomly started trying to kill them because of a rogue, you know, Cardassian computer program. And it's like, you know, after that, I would probably report, like, you know, if my coffee tasted wrong, I would be like, ah, security, the station's trying to kill us again.
I ordered two sugars. Oh, God.
This is how it starts.
This is the end.
So anyway, that's one of my episodes that I kind of enjoy ironically, just because of how silly it is. And I will admit, I really enjoy Spock's brain, even though it's terrible. It is so bad. I still like it. It's not like, there are some episodes of TOS that are kind of just sort of offensive that I don't like for those reasons, but, like, with Spock's brain, it's kind of like, everything in this episode is so dumb, it's hard for me to be offended by any of it. Like, I mean, you know, you have these super, this, like, super bright underground world where you have these ladies who are saying things like, brain and brain, what is brain? And then you have, like, the stupid cavemen up on the top, and they're like, the bringers of pain and pleasure, and it's like, what? Who wrote this? Who thought this was a good idea? Okay, those are two of my episodes. What do you guys got?
Sorry. I'm still cracking up.
It's okay, Grace. Everything will be okay.
Oh, okay.
What was that?
That was a snort. Sometimes those happen.
Shut up.
You know, when I get going. But Bob, what episodes do you enjoy ironically?
That I enjoy ironically? Or the Little Green Men from DS9.
Oh, classic.
Yeah, okay. I'll give it that. Although that one is a little bit more, that one's kind of intentional.
Yeah.
You think that's intentionally kitschy?
I think that's kind of what they're going for. At least I hope so. Otherwise, mm-hmm. I'm just really confused as to why that was an episode.
Well, because it looks like they were really trying to cash in on the whole, like, sort of silly 1950s or 60s UFO movie.
Yeah.
You know, including, like, because they have, like, those two, like, the Air Force sergeant, or maybe it was a lieutenant, and his, like...
Yes, so we know all about you, baseball, atomic bombs, yes.
Spear. That's the line that makes it. Root beer.
Root beer.
Root beer.
I'd much rather deal with you Australians.
Didgeridoos. Kangaroos.
Boomerangs? You got any boomerangs around? I do really like the idea of... I also feel like that episode was kind of making fun of Star Trek's habit of monocultures.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, because it's like, you know, you show up on Earth and you just start rattling off random bits of culture from around the planet and assume it applies to everybody. It's like, that sounds kind of strange.
Yeah.
So, you know, it would probably be the same if you went to Vulcan and, like, just you assumed all Vulcans liked the same
things. There's a level of self-deprecation in that episode that makes it genuinely enjoyable. So. Mm-hmm. And for my pick, I think I'm going to have to say the episode that introduces Reg Barclay. Because it is so damn weird.
Yeah, Hollow Pursuits, I think it's called.
Yeah, Hollow Pursuits. So because it's just one of those episodes where you can be following the plot completely. You can know the characters, you can know what the holodeck is, you can be following it, but still just be like, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah.
It's pretty much the main crew gets caught in Barclay's... sort of mentally masturbatory holodeck program.
His holo fantasy?
Yeah.
Well, they don't get caught in it. It's not like it starts trying to kill them. It's actually, I think what it is that he has like a breakdown and like goes into the holodeck and doesn't realize that they're not his holodeck characters for a while. And they're like exploring his, like, you know, his really surreal like fantasy world where he has Riker, who's super short. I love super short Riker. Yeah. That's my favorite part of that episode, is super short Riker.
I don't know. Goddess of Empathy, Counselor Troi, is pretty great. Just in the what reaction that she gets to it.
Yeah, the look that she has is pretty priceless. So here's a thought, Grace. Do you think that that episode is a dig at Star Trek fans? Because I've heard that said. Some people don't like it because they feel like Star Trek is, you know, insulting its fan base.
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, it does bring up this idea of getting sort of lost in a fantasy world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like Dumbledore said, it is much better to do... It isn't... I'm messing up this quote, aren't I?
What did Dumbledore say?
He said words. He said, you know, it's something about dwelling on dreams and forgetting to live. It does not do to dwell on dreams and forget to live. That's the one. So, well, as fans, we do really enjoy sort of this sort of sci-fi dimension that we've built for ourselves. It isn't real, and at the end of the day, we kind of do need to walk away from it sometimes, but it's so easy and so wonderful to get caught up in it.
What do you mean it's not real? I have a podcast about it. Podcast
can't... That was going to be high point. It's like, do you know where you are right now?
It can't not be real.
We're all things Trek on TrekRadio.net right now, live, on the website, allthingstrek.com. It's like,
the world we have built out of it is very real.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
So
anyway, it could be kind of seen as that, like a jab at this sense of escapism that a lot of fans get from Star Trek and get from a lot of the different fandoms.
Yeah, it could be. I've always, frankly...
I wouldn't say it's that much of a bad thing that they're kind of making it out to be.
Yeah, I mean, people do tend to get kind of sensitive about that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I, frankly, I'm amazed that Barclay is an unusual case.
Yeah.
Like... I think if there were...
Holodeck addiction would probably be a thing.
Yeah, I mean, considering how many people I know nowadays who play more video games than they should, and like their rest of their life suffers because video games provide such a like an immediate gratification. Yeah. And I can understand. I like video games too. And it's sometimes hard to be like, we should stop and do something else.
Yeah.
And, you know, all things in moderation and all that junk. But if you can imagine how much more immersive a holodeck is,
yeah,
like so
definitely.
Many people would be addicted to holodecks. You know, maybe not a like a crippling number, like it probably wouldn't cause the downfall of society, but I definitely think it would be more common than this one weird guy has that problem. You know.
Aren't we all just that one weird guy though, Oren? Aren't we all?
I'm pretty sure I'm that one mean guy. if I had to pick an identity for myself.
Fair enough. I'm not gonna argue with that.
Oh, that's fair. There's another couple of episodes that I kind of watch them ironically just because they're so silly, and I think one of them is This Side of Paradise, which for anyone who doesn't remember what that one is, that's the TOS episode where they go to this planet of flowers that shoot confetti onto you, and then you become super happy.
They called it on Futurama, the one where you got hopped up on spores and slapped Kirk around.
Did they mention that?
Yeah.
Oh, dear. but, like, for me, that episode is, like, I watch it because it's really kind of slow. And the first time I watched it, I was just like, this is really boring. I didn't like it. But after I'd thought about it for a while and just realized how ridiculous some of those scenes are, where, like, the flowers are, like, poking into the frame, like they're walking around on little root legs or something. Somehow the flowers are ambulatory.
The flowers are a really, really territorial set piece, I guess.
Yeah, and there's like a scene where it looks like Kirk is trying to crew the ship with flowers. Like, I don't think he was doing that intentionally, but like there's a bunch of flowers like at the various control stations.
I got this, bro. Oh man, I need to make a meme now. Hang on, I gotta find a picture.
What are you doing, Bob? What's happening on your end?
I'm totally going to make this with the flower on the bridge at, like, the helm, and the title is going to be I Got This.
If nothing else comes from this episode, we've got that.
And I can't, you know, nowadays, and it's got so many, like, really, like, you know, when the scene, like, all, like, I can't, when I first saw McCoy going around offering,
mint
you know,
juleps.
Offering mint juleps, I was just like, oh, come on. But now it's like that will always be my mint julep episode. I will always just remember McCoy being like, "Hey Jim, have a mint julep." It's like, although it was pointed out by the Mission Log podcast a couple of days ago that he mentions a Georgia style mint julep, and mint juleps are from Kentucky. They are not from Georgia.
Well, maybe there's, I don't know. It's the future. They've probably come up with a few new drinks.
Maybe
Georgia. They do it differently in Georgia than they do in Kentucky.
New Jersey style barbecue.
Maybe they drink their Georgia-style mint juleps while watching the Georgia Derby.
And I mean, but even from a more serious standpoint, that episode brings up a really, really interesting conflict and then completely dismisses it, which is the idea of actually achieving happiness, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's this sort of this weird dichotomy between the pursuit of happiness versus actually getting happiness. And Star Trek over and over again has sort of established this, especially in the original series, has established this right to suffer, as it were.
Maybe like, it's more about, you know, like, earning your happiness. That's what I always got from it.
Because Kirk is always, like, finding people who are, like, who think they're happy and being like, you can't be happy! Like, you know, in Return of the Archons, he destroys Landru. He destroys Landru. Landru. Oh, that's why they only have, like, the one uniform. And This Side of Paradise is really the most obvious example of that, because Kirk is just like, no, none of you guys can live on this planet and be self-sufficient and happy.
And I think the idea is that it was making everyone on the crew all shiftless and abandoning their posts.
Yes, and
the problem was they did have the right to be happy, but not if it was getting in the way of Kirk's business.
Yeah, I mean, Kirk needed to go fly a spaceship somewhere.
He has stuff
I guess.
To do. He's a busy man.
But I really felt like
ain't nobody's happiness getting in that way.
You know, I really felt like the obvious like thing to do in that situation was to, you know, wake all the colonists up, right, by pissing them off, because that was how they freed them, and then be like, all right, so now that you're not being affected by spores, we'll explain to you what the spores do, and then give you the option to go back if you want, because I really feel like, you know, those colonists had the right to do that if they wanted to. I mean, they built a colony, and they were farming and feeding themselves. They were not, and, you know, they were going out and enjoying life. That was basically all they did all day. And I really feel like if they wanted to do that, I don't think Kirk should have had the right to tell them that they can't. But for some reason, Kirk is like, no, we have to get you off this planet away from the happy flowers.
Makes you wonder what other kind of plant people don't or do have the right to farm and hang around and be happy by all day.
Grace, are you being topical?
No.
No? Okay. Just making sure. I thought maybe you were being topical for a minute there.
My sense motive roll is tingling.
Oh, and just in case anyone didn't catch what I said earlier, I would definitely recommend going and listening to the Mission Log episode on Side of Paradise, because they had a really fun discussion. So Grace, I have a question about this thing you put here in your show notes.
Yeah.
Where you wrote, do true fans have the right to be offended?
The true fans thing is actually something that needs a little explaining. All right. One of the earlier notes, one of the things I wanted to discuss was the idea of enthusiasm in the show. Ironic enthusiasm versus genuine enthusiasm. And mm-hmm. like you can see what we've been talking about, even though we have been talking about the really kitschy, the really silly stuff, we have been all evidently taking something serious out of it. Like you've been, what am I trying to say here? Like we found some things that were genuinely good about the campy kitschy episodes. Like we mm-hmm. found something that was genuinely worth discussing and worth contemplating. And how do the people who watch the show for that, to get something out of it, stack up against the people who just watch it strictly in the sense of, haha, look how dumb this is, let's laugh at it, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Does that make, is there a difference between a genuine fan and an ironic fan? And if so, are they like different tiers of nerddom? I mean, there was a really good article in the New York Times a few months ago about ironic culture and this idea of hipsterdom, and that the real difference in this ironic culture is, if you're genuine, you really like something completely, whereas if you're liking it ironically, there's this kind of tongue-in-cheek attitude about saying, oh, yeah, I totally like this, wink. That kind of thing, you know?
All right, well, here's my question. This is something that I guess we're going to veer off into talking about hipster for a minute. The idea of liking something ironically. Now, you know, like I said, there are a couple episodes of Star Trek that I know are bad. But I enjoy watching them, right?
Yeah.
But I'm not lying when I say I enjoy watching them. I do enjoy watching them, just not for the same reason that the creators intended.
Yeah.
Like, the same way that I know a guy at work who will only watch bad Enterprise episodes.
Oh, why?
Because he doesn't really like Star Trek.
Is he a masochist?
He doesn't really like Star Trek, but he thinks he finds the really bad episodes to be funny. But, like, I don't think that means that he is pretending to like Star Trek. He just likes it for a different reason than I would.
That's what I want to know. Is there like a type of genuine fan?
And I mean, I think my instinct to that would be no, because I mean, you could have people who like it more than others, and I think you're going to find, like, if the only reason you watch Star Trek is because you like laughing at the bad ones, you're probably not as into it as someone like, you know, you or me or Bob, who have watched a lot of the episodes.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that you're a fake fan. That just means that you find enjoyment in a different part of it than other people. And I frankly, I am very skeptical.
Is there an example of a fake fan?
Huh? Well,
give me an example of a fake fan. What is a fake fan?
That's kind of what I'm getting to, is I have heard very often, especially in Seattle, I feel like, maybe this happens other places too, but it feels like a lot in Seattle, I hear the term hipster thrown around a lot. And I don't think hipsters are real. I think calling someone a hipster is basically the same thing as calling them a dick. It's an insult, but it's not a group of people. Because the idea is that hipsters are people who do things that they don't actually like because they think that's cool. Like,
for the sake of irony.
For the sake of irony.
Yeah.
And Lillian just held up a cool thing saying hipsters are trolls. And
pretty
that's,
much,
that's,
pop,
you know,
pop culture trolls, in a sense.
Yeah, I suppose, but like...
Or just cultural trolls.
I mean, I guess if they're just trying to, you know, provoke a reaction out of me, but I wouldn't even call... I don't think that's what most people mean when they say hipster.
Yeah.
I think what people mean when they say hipster, I think, is people who dress differently than they do, and you have different preferences, and they've convinced themselves that the reason for that is because those people are doing things that are uncool deliberately because they think that makes them cooler.
Yeah.
But I don't think those people are real. I don't think they exist in any large numbers.
You haven't been to Olympia in a while, I'm guessing.
But I think most of those people probably think those things are cool.
Maybe for different reasons, but yeah,
I guess. But I don't know. Just if you think about it, like the hipster, the way hipsters get described to me at least is this person who is doing something really stupid, which is liking something that is not cool, and doing it because they think they're smarter than you.
Yeah.
So they're like the perfect group of people to hate. They're also completely harmless, so they're not scary in any way. And I find that very convenient, you know? And so I think that calling someone a hipster, you can do that if you want, but it's just an insult.
Yeah.
I find the idea, and I guess I'm a bit of a tangent here, but it sort of ties back.
A bit.
It ties back to my thing that I don't think there's any such thing as an ironic fan. I think there are just some people who only like the stupid bits of Star Trek, and they enjoy them for the comedy value.
Okay.
You know, every once in a while, I will watch a bad episode of Enterprise to laugh at it. You know, it's not good. I don't like it. I don't like it for how it was originally presented. But
yeah.
I can enjoy some of the stupidness just because it makes me laugh.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I think there's that. And I wouldn't, I don't really think that there's such a, I don't really think that you could divide people into true fans and ironic fans. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like for me, it's more of a, with Doctor Who, there are some old, really weird Doctor Who episodes that I will watch more because I think they're unintentionally funny than for any other reason. But I don't think that makes me an ironic Doctor Who fan.
Okay.
Am I making any sense? Does anyone understand what I mean?
I think that this whole thing got me thinking about, that was redundant again, this sort of sense of nerd hierarchy, like the whole idea of the fake nerd versus the true nerd.
Oh my god.
Because
Jesus.
That's been kind of a thing lately.
Oh, I get so mad whenever people bring up that idea, especially the idea of the fake nerd girl.
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir.
Yeah, I know. I know I'm preaching to the choir. I want to preach anyway, but I'm not gonna.
Yeah.
It's just, suffice it to say, I hate it when people talk about that. So I think, there is definitely a sense of elitism going on there.
Definitely. That's why I brought it up.
What do you know? Relevancy.
I know, but I'm as surprised as you are.
So I have another question. What does this show note mean? Trekkies, are they laughing at us?
Okay, that was one thing that I also was curious about. The movie Trekkies, the documentaries Trekkies and Trekkies 2.
I've never seen those.
Oh, they're very fun to watch, but a lot of the funness of it is looking at sort of the extremity of how some people take their being a fan of Star Trek, like people opening up Star Trek-themed dentist's office, or like having their ears surgically changed to look Vulcan, and that sort of sense of, yep, this is what some people do, this is the fan thing. And you got to wonder, though, is this a view of them laughing at us or with us, just sort of as a Trekkie community thing? And I know that's a little off topic, but, you know, it feels like it's sort of turning the fans of Star Trek into something that you're laughing at along with laughing at Star Trek.
Hmm. Yeah, well, that's a thought. I feel like in most cases people do that out of a genuine, you know, enjoyment of the franchise.
Yeah.
Especially, well, I mean, people who get themselves surgically altered to appear more Star Trek-y, I'm pretty sure that is because they really like Star Trek.
Well,
I think you would be hard pressed to find someone who did that to make fun of Trekkies.
I'm saying that is it possible that people are seeing us as just making a spectacle of ourselves as fans and laughing at that also?
Yeah, and that's possible. I mean, I know that, my parents for a really long time had a big cutout of Spock that they kept in the living room more as a conversation piece than anything else.
Oh yeah, Spock's a conversation starter.
Yeah. Although
I've seen my fine Spock stand up.
And I do think it is possible to, like, make fun of someone's franchise in, like, a really mean-spirited way. I don't actually see it all that often, thankfully. And the only time I can think of off the top of my head was, and this was the way something was described to me, actually, not, I haven't read it myself.
Yeah.
But there's a book out called Night of the Living Trekkie.
Yeah.
Which is a zombie outbreak at a Star Trek convention. Which is like, okay, sure. But there's a section in it that, is actually, like, it's one of the characters who was there is actually dressed as Slave Leia, from like And the way they described that part made it sound like a very mean-spirited dig at Star Wars. I was listening to this on another podcast, a review of the book. And that may not be true. Like I said, I have not read the book.
Yeah.
So it may not actually be like that. But that was kind of what it felt like for that. Is that sometimes, you know, when you make fun of someone, you know, when you make fun of a franchise, it's like, oh, that's just, you know, we're just making fun of the funny parts about that franchise, like the Futurama Star Trek or the Futurama Star Trek episode or Galaxy Quest are both really hilarious, right? Yeah. Whereas William Shatner, when he famously said "Get a life," that was not really, that was just mean, and I think he's, you know, kind of either come around or realize that his popularity is dependent on him appearing to have come around from that sentiment.
I think he's kind of embraced this idea that he has to be camp or pretty much be irrelevant.
That's possible.
Which is harsh, but I think that's kind of what the deal is.
Yeah, well, I mean, as good as he was on Boston Legal, that isn't going to sustain him in his old age.
Yeah.
Bob, what do you have anything to say about this?
Not really. I think you guys are on a roll. So I mean, keep going. If you guys say something though that is flat out wrong, I'll be sure to let you know.
All right. Hang on. Okay. Let's see. In the Pale Moonlight is the worst episode of Star Trek.
Hold up.
Don't worry, I hit him.
He did. Right on the face.
right on the face. Right. Well, very good.
On the face.
Right.
So, I guess maybe just on the comment of being a fan or so, you know, what makes a true fan, or even in relation to Trekkies, you know, laughing at people, whatever it is. I suppose, you know, there isn't really, I mean, or you kind of said it, there isn't really a whole lot of material necessarily in relation to other material about people liking stuff versus actually writing like a hate piece against the fans of something. I mean, sure, you'll have, you know, people expressing their opinions about, oh my God, all Trek fans are this way, or all Star Wars fans are this way, or all Firefly fans are this way.
That's just
and that just falls into the idea of what we have of the subject called stereotypes. I mean, that's all that really falls under. But as far as being a fan, I think there's not really levels of fan at all. Yeah, I think it's either you're a fan or you're not. To what extreme you carry that of being a fan is entirely, you know, up to you. Mm-hmm. And that can be subjective in of itself, right? Just being a fan. You know, like, I have, like, Star Trek novels and such, but would I surgically alter myself? No, because I have a career that, you know, very much has me interface with the public, and running around with pointed ears might be a little distracting for me to be able to do that. So, you know, I have to,
unlike Barclay, you know, not go do something like that. Step outside of the holodeck.
Yeah, exactly. It's a good
analogy, isn't it?
I mean, I really think that people should appreciate and, you know, employ their level of fandom however they wish, but not do it to the detriment of their life or so. Because, you know, I mean, we've all heard of, you know, the basement virgin, obviously, right? That just sits in their basement all day and they're on their computer and they're just watching Star Trek all day or whatever it might be. You know, it's like that's a very detrimental activity, and that's very much a negative stereotype in relation to, you know, anybody who might be a fan of anything, right? So that's really just kind of my thought on it.
Being a fan,
you know, just make sure that you are, if you are a fan of something, I suppose maybe this is kind of more of a PSA.
Okay.
If you are a fan of something, just make sure that being a fan of that particular subject matter is healthy. Don't let it be something that is going to interfere with, you know, as it's kind of been said, with your life. You got to make sure that you can live your life, you know, whatever life that may be.
So
or maybe your life is to be that basement-dwelling troll that's just there, you know, in which case, Godspeed, but, you know.
So other than that, it really doesn't depend on how much you like something or why you like it, just the fact that you're enjoying it and that you are living your life and enjoying it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and, you know, and next on a very special episode of All Things Trek, we will discuss
why
you have to be okay with how you look.
You have to love you for you!
But actually, I want to in the chat room. Racer X made an interesting comment that he said, "Yeah, I hate having to hide my comm badge in my pocket at work." and that's an interesting thought, because obviously Star Trek is becoming more mainstream, right?
Yeah.
In fact, science fiction in general is becoming more mainstream and less like, "Oh, you're real weird because you like science fiction."
Yeah.
But I still, you know, I think that if you brought in, say, for example, if you decided to wear like a cool like earring that was based on like a yin yang.
Yeah.
That would be, you know, no one would look twice at that. Mm-hmm. But if you came in with an earring that was a Star Trek com badge, people would be like, oh, what's that? and they might, you know, they might judge you differently, right? And it's sort of like, what's, you know, this is a funny conversation in the chat room.
Yeah,
I'm not gonna talk about
we're getting
that.
Distracted by that.
but, so, you know, there, even though there is like this, the idea of, you know, of people just liking what they like.
Yeah.
There is still, I think, a certain degree of there is still a certain degree of stigmatization that comes with it.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, if for no other reason than because I still like to pretend to be a victim sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, I like to imagine that I'm being.
There's a level of martyrdom. Like, no, mm-hmm. I am the bigger fan. You don't understand me.
Yeah, you don't understand my pain. You know, I was into Star Trek before it was cool.
Yeah, there was a lot of that going around when the newest Star Trek movie came out. It attracted a bunch of new fans and stuff, and they're like, yeah, I'm a really big fan of the new Trek. And then they're like, oh, well, if you're not a fan of the old Trek, then you're not a real fan. And yeah, so I saw lots of that happening, and that was just a pain in the ass.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I guess
that would come down to deriving, you know, different values from the same media.
Yeah,
that's all that is. I mean, because, you know, if there is someone out there, I have yet to meet them and have them included in my personal life that does like the new Star Trek movie as opposed to the old Trek more. You know, or just straight up likes the new movie and dislikes with every fiber of their being the old Star Trek, that still makes them a Star Trek fan.
Yeah.
You know, that's just the way it is. You know, they just happen to derive a different value out of the media than I did.
Right.
You know, that's all that is. But that doesn't make them wrong necessarily. Yeah. That just makes their fandom different from my fandom of the related subject matter.
And I have to say that, I mean, some of the people that I work with, I have gotten the comments, you know, like how they how much more they enjoy the new Star Trek than the old. So I actually know a couple of people who do prefer, and I will admit, it does hurt me on the inside when they say that. But I'd like to think it has more to do with the fact that there is so much better stuff to be found in some of the older Trek than the new Trek. Like, I'd like to think that if this came out, if I was talking about this during, say, Star Trek 2, and I ran into a bunch of people who were like, yeah, we really love Star Trek 2, but we didn't like Star Trek the Motion Picture, I wouldn't be like, how dare you not like Star Trek the Motion Picture?
You're not a purist!
You know, because Star Trek the Motion Picture was terrible. I'd like to think that I would be able to be like, yeah, you like this new thing that is better, and, you know, and that it...
Or that you find better.
Yeah, and that it wouldn't have anything to do with that, but, you know, the, But for the new, for the new Trek, the main reason, I'd like to think the reason I don't much care for the opinion that it's the best Trek is because it's not. It's just not very good, when it comes down to certain elements of it, like story and villain. Which is why, yeah, I mean, like I said, I have high hopes for 2013. Yes.
No. F you, Oren. I love Neelix. You saw passion and bleeding on him and you blah, blah, blah. Yeah, as a person yelling, that would be a fan too.
Yeah, I guess there are probably
in the chat room.
I've been encountering them.
Really?
Yeah, I listen to a lot of Star Trek podcasts.
Wait, are you saying they're real?
They are. They're not just a scary story that we tell our little Trek fans to make them go to sleep at night.
If you're out there listening, we know. That was me making contact with the other side.
Sounds like it's them to sleep with a gun under my pillow.
Well, I mean, it seems like...
Don't be silly. I sleep with a bat under my pillow.
Well, here's the thing about Neelix. The one thing that I've actually discovered that is a fairly common trait among people who like Neelix is that they started watching Voyager late in its arc. And so they didn't ever see... They didn't start with... the Neelix of Caretaker, right? or any
they didn't have to see naked Neelix and get started with that.
That wasn't the first image of Neelix. Like for them, you know, they started with later Neelix, who I still hate, but I will admit is less annoying. And so then when they, you know, when they went back and watched the original, you know, the early Neelix, they're kinda like, well, he's not good, but they forgive him.
Yeah.
So it's like, even though I will never agree with that sentiment, I can kind of understand it.
Yeah.
In the same way that I think a lot of, if someone only ever watched, you know, Star Trek's Next Generation Season 1, and, you know, and then tried to watch, and then like a couple of years later, after formulating their opinions of TNG based on Season 1, came back and tried to watch the rest, they might, even though the rest is obviously better, I think they might still be like, no, I don't like see, I don't like.
There's that nothing obvious when it comes to opinions. That's the thing. All opinions are arguable.
What? No, they're not. I have my opinion prover right over here. I type in opinions into it, and it tells me which ones are correct. It always tells me mine are correct, so there you go.
You're correct, Aaron.
there you go. You guys heard it here first on All Things Trek.
The correct machine. The opinion validator.
Admiral Trade says, I actually started watching Voyager when they started rerunning it on Spike, but they started at the beginning. I kind of liked Neelix. All right, hang on a minute. Do you think this building is tall enough to kill me on impact if I jumped off of it?
They've made contact.
Yeah, but they're speaking a language I don't understand. Maybe if we start like talking prime numbers at them, they'll, you know, we can communicate.
Chaka, when the walls fell. Tarmac and Flood at Tanagra.
Nah, we kid because we love, and you have every right to like Neelix, and we like you because you like him.
We do? I wouldn't go that far.
Oren.
I'm sorry.
Don't be a hipster.
Alright, hang on. He says, Strand says, I wonder if there's anyone who has a strong opinion on Mayweather, one way or the other. I have a strong opinion on Mayweather. He's boring. That's my opinion.
Is this us staying on topic?
No, this is a new topic. I've moved on. Mayweather is really, really, like, he's wasted is what he is. He's a main cast member who barely does anything. The closest Mayweather ever gets to being cool is in, like, the fourth season episode with Terra Prime, when he has his ex-girlfriend, who is either a Terra Prime agent or a spy infiltrating Terra Prime. And honestly, I can't remember which one she turned out to be. But, you know, suddenly he had a girlfriend who apparently was a really big deal that we'd never heard about before. But, you know, whatever, new writers. So, I mean, like, he's just, like, he is theoretically important in Fortunate Son, which is a terrible episode. But even in Fortunate Son.
But actually a pretty good CCR song. For the record. For the record.
But even in that episode, he feels kind of, you know, like he takes a backseat to Archer, because Archer is the one who makes all the important decisions in that episode, and he's kind of like, hey, Mayweather, I need you to help me talk down these crazy other space people. Can you speak space? Can you translate for me? is kind of the feeling that I got from watching that.
If you ever run another Star Trek RPG, I want that skill. Space speak.
Space speak?
Space speak. I want that skill.
Space speak?
Much as I would like to run another Star Trek RPG, it's probably going to be a while. I have a whole another campaign planned. Maybe after that. Maybe I could reconfigure Burning Empires to run Star Trek. But, alright, that's way off topic. That is so off topic, it's not even
Yeah,
funny.
We've gone so far off the mark now.
All right, Grace. Well, since this is your project, I will let you lead back into our. What do you want to talk about?
Okay. Well, either way, no matter how we enjoy Star Trek in its incarnations, whether it's so good it's bad, or whether it's because it's so good that we won't see anything bad, or whether it's so good we love it, or whether we love it because it's nuts, we like it, and that's what we're here to talk about. But part of, I think, what has become sort
sometimes
of
it's abusive.
I know, right? And that's what I'm saying.
Sometimes it's abusive and does things like Enterprise, but we stick
exactly.
around anyway.
And part of what we seem to be doing as a fan culture is embracing that campness and that sort of, oh yeah, that sucked, and being able to sort of laugh at it and not taking it too seriously. So what do we do with that? What do we do with this?
Well, I'm always
trying to laugh at ourselves as a fandom and being able to sort of take the jabs and stuff.
All right, well, here's the thing. This is something, maybe I may be the only person in the universe who has ever encountered this problem, but when I talk about Star Trek, especially at work, I tend to be as critical of certain parts of it there as I am here, right?
Yeah.
And so I have a number of people who at work have commented that I must not really be a very big Star Trek fan because I, you know, when I talk about how much I don't like Enterprise.
Oh no, you critique because you love.
And well, that's sort of my point is I have spent a lot of time fighting this idea that because you're a Star Trek fan, you have to love everything about Star Trek. And it's like, you know, it's like, no, that being a Star Trek fan doesn't mean I can't be critical. It doesn't mean I can't be discerning in what I like and don't like.
You can be a fan with an opinion.
Especially because, like, the whole idea, like, part of the reason I think that Star Trek went downhill the way it did was that the fans, it was just sort of assumed that whatever they put on the screen, the fans would watch. Mm. And I mean, you know, like, that's, I think that was part of the problem with Enterprise, was that Enterprise had such, like, the people they hired to write Enterprise scripts had such a short resume that they probably came pretty cheap. And I don't know this for a fact. I'm speculating here.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at, like, all the writers who are not Berman and Braga in Enterprise, a lot of them have tiny resumes and have hardly written anything before they got to write an Enterprise episode.
Oh, goodness.
And it really feels like they were trying to save money.
Yeah.
Same reason why I think they fired Ron Jones.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it was just coincidentally that his album had gone gold, and he probably could have demanded a higher paycheck at that point. And so that's kind of, like, I feel like there was like a money saving idea that is not the only reason why Enterprise was bad, but was part of the reason. So they were just, you know, so that I think, and they, because they just assumed everyone would like it.
Yeah.
It just kind of went downhill. And if anything, I think that was a problem with Voyager, was that, especially because if you look at like the end of Voyager, right, it's been stated by numerous people, most bitterly by Robert Beltran,
mm-hmm.
but by a lot of people, that there was no plan for the end of Voyager. They just got to the end and they were like, all right, this is the last episode.
They hit their wall.
Yeah, there was no, you know, there was no lead up.
Yeah.
And, you know, people kept watching, and I think that they took from that, well, no one cares what we do. which is actually something that I've seen, I read an interview that the writers of 24 had the same problem.
Yeah.
Was that in the first season of 24, they were like, we're going to plan out everything super meticulously, right?
Yeah.
Make sure everything makes sense. In second season, there was a writer's strike. They couldn't do that. They didn't notice any noticeable, there wasn't any noticeable drop in viewership. So they were like, no one cares. And so they just gave up. And I've never watched 24 beyond a couple of episodes.
Yeah.
But I'd like to think that people would notice that and, you know, notice that the show was getting worse. Because if we aren't critical, we're never going to get anything better, right? Because why should the people who make our entertainment work harder if we aren't going to appreciate it more, right?
True, yeah.
That's my feelings on the matter.
Kind of like the idea of, should we be thanking them for any bone they throw us?
Yeah, I mean, I'm of the opinion that, I mean, I don't want to be mean most of the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, for the most part...
And yet here you are.
And here I am. for the most part, I do try to feel like... I do feel like it is my responsibility, even as someone who enjoys entertainment, to be critical of that entertainment.
So you are critical because you love.
I suppose.
Aww.
if we want to put love in there.
I complain because I care.
You know, actually, Shran in the chat room, I'm going to go ahead and say that I kind of enjoyed Minefield, and maybe that's because I was inundated by Enterprise episodes, but Minefield was an episode that actually seemed to have some tension to it, because, you know, that's for anyone who doesn't remember, Minefield is the episode where they roll up on a minefield.
Oh, no!
And it, like, turns out to be a Romulan minefield, and one of the mines is attached to their hull. And it's a little silly when, like...
when you put it like that?
Well, no, it's a little bit silly because, like... what's his name? Reed gets, like, trapped to the hull by the mine, and is like, you know, they have to...
What was he doing on the hull?
Well, he's trying to disarm it. I actually liked that part. The part where... Because there's the cool part where, like, Reed goes out to try to disarm the mine.
Yeah.
And I think that was a really cool part. The part where he gets, like, stuck to the hull by the by the mine sending out a spike was a little silly. And then the part where Archer goes out to try to talk... to try to help him was even sillier.
Was, like, he trying to talk down the mine?
No, he was trying to disarm it, but really... Really, all he was
talk
doing
to the bomb.
What?
He wasn't trying to talk down the mine. He was trying to disarm it via Reed's, via Reed's instructions. But really, anybody could have done that. There was no reason for it to be Archer. It was like, you know,
because Scott Bakula. That's why.
Like, did they not have anyone else who was knowledgeable with explosives? Oh, and Mr. Link 8909. You are correct. Deep Space Nine does have the best characters, straight up. Just, you know, even though Picard's my favorite captain, I think it's unquestionable that Deep Space Nine had the best ensemble cast.
And he will critique the hell out of them because he loves them.
Because I love them. Except Esri. I don't love Esri.
Meh. Meh.
Meh.
Meh.
Meh. Is that how we're going to end this? Meh.
I guess so. Maybe is there, like, a higher point you can think we can end it on?
No, I think I really enjoyed this topic. I know what we're going to be talking about next week. I'm excited.
Yeah.
We're going to be discussing a topic that was sent to us via an email, which is going to be other shows that have influenced pop culture in the same way that Star Trek has. So it will be all things pop culture, in addition to all things Trek.
All things, I guess.
Yes. And then the week after that, I'm really hoping I will attract us down a copy of Star Trek Fleet Captains, and we may be reviewing that. Maybe. I'm not going to promise.
Is there nothing on, like, Amazon.com?
Well, I'm going to try to get it from a local game store.
Listeners, help us! Tell us where to find it!
Well, it's new. I'm pretty sure I can find it at one of the, like...
I'm trying to crowdsource.
Crowdsource?
Yeah.
All right, guys, so I'm going to start as a Kickstarter, and our goal is going to be $5,000, because Starfleet, Star Trek Fleet Captains is really expensive.
Also, we need a new car.
No.
Every additional $10 you put over our $5,000 buys me a margarita.
Screw your margaritas, I need my Starbucks fix. I'm not joking here. Tell them, Oren, tell them how hard I'm not joking.
Grace has been very upset that she hasn't had any coffee this morning. Yeah. I tried to make her tea, but it just doesn't seem to work.
No, it's not the same. It's just hot leaf juice.
To think that a member of my own podcast would say such a thing.
And now we're officially off topic again.
All right.
That seems like a good note to end it on, right?
All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening, guys.
All right. See you next week.